Title, A Man After God's Own Heart. Brother Colin.
Good morning, brothers and sisters.
Good morning.
Since we covered the last events in yesterday's period rather quickly, brothers and sisters, we'd like just to highlight some of them again by way of review and by way of introduction to our summary period this morning. Would you turn in your Bibles to First of Samuel, chapter 15. Let's make that 2 Samuel 15. A little further on than that. Thank you. 2 Samuel chapter 15. Just looking again at this section which we went through rather quickly yesterday to reinforce some of the key points that we shouldn't miss or forget, because this is at one of the most critical points in David's life. Here we see in 2 Samuel chapter 15, and we looked yesterday at verse 14, that upon news of Absalom's revolt, David flees Jerusalem. We considered yesterday how David fled, a humiliated and a tormented man. Yet, when he did flee at this point, we can see he had resigned himself to accept whatever God brought his way. You know, that comes out so very, very clear when we look at David as he ascends the mount across the Kidron. Just if we went over to 2 Samuel chapter 16, took a look at the reaction that David has to one of his persecutors. Verse 9 of 2 Samuel 16. We didn't consider the role of Shimei here yesterday, but let's not miss what it reveals to us. Shimei had been in David's court within the realm of his close associates, and Shimei seizes the opportunity to rail against David as David ascends the Mount of Olives. In verse 9, beside David was Abishai at this time, one of the sons of Zeruiah, brother to Joab. Abishai can't stand to see David railed against. Notice how the son of Zeruiah responds to the circumstances of Shimei's railing against David. Verse 9. Then said Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, unto the king, "Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over, I pray thee, and take off his head." And the king said, "What have I to do with you, ye sons of Zeruiah? So let him curse, because the Lord hath said unto him, Curse David. Who shall then say, Wherefore hast thou done so?" And David said to Abishai and to all his servants, "Behold, my son, which came forth of my bowels, seeketh my life. How much more now may this Benjaminite do it? Let him alone, and let him curse, for the Lord hath bidden him. It may be that the Lord will look on mine affliction, and that the Lord will requite me good for his cursing this day." That, brothers and sisters, is terribly revealing about the change in David's disposition and character. Let your mind think back to that incident with Nabal, when David would have snuffed out his life because of the indignity which David suffered at Nabal's hand. A man who was not thankful for David's protective wall that he had provided by his men. David, really, at that time, responded very much like Abishai does here towards Shimei. But what has made the difference in David's character? How is it that he can now accept with gentle resignation the railing of Shimei? David has changed. He has matured. He has acquired a godly resignation to his circumstances. He is no longer resisting the circumstances of life the way he did once before. David, as a result of these many vicissitudes, and in particular as a result of his humiliation by his sin with Bathsheba, has come to know himself perhaps better than he ever did before. And brothers and sisters, that's revealing. It is in the realization of our human frailties. It is when we look at ourselves in the mirror and truly see ourselves to be what we are, left to ourselves, that we come to terms with our circumstances in the way that David did. As we grow and mature in the truth, the more we realize that we have feet of clay, the more we recognize our own human frailties, the more we come to see God's hand working faithfully in our lives, the more we can live day by day with that peace which passes all understanding. When we're younger in the truth, we often fight circumstances. We resist the difficulties, the trials, and the problems of life. We persist in asking that old question, why me? Why now? But David, brothers and sisters, has come to the end of that road, or at least close to the end of it. And we see in him that kind of resignation that all of us should begin to develop. It's not indifference that David expresses here. It's not, oh well, whatever will come, que sera, sera, as they say back in Canada, whatever will be, will be. That's not the attitude. It's the recognition, thy will be done. Do you know, it's a curious thing, brothers and sisters, that David expresses this kind of resignation. Though he doesn't say, thy will be done, that's really the essence of his attitude. And where does he come to grips, or at least where does he reveal that resignation? It's here on the Mount of Olives. He has fled Jerusalem, he has crossed the Kidron, and he's now ascending the Mount of Olives, footsteps to be taken years later by the Lord Jesus Christ. And at night, on this very mount, the Lord Jesus Christ, in this very basic location, in Gethsemane, will wrestle all night long, and the essence of his struggle will be, shall this cup pass from me, or shall I drink of it? Will the Lord resign himself to the cross fully and drink deeply of that cup, or will he not? Finally, the expression in the Gospels is, thy will be done. That was the end of the struggle. That was the resignation that Jesus came to. And it's marvelous, brothers and sisters, to see David expressing that resignation right here on the Mount of Olives as he too has had to flee from Jerusalem. As he walks up this mount, barefoot and humiliated, as his friends have turned up their heel against him, as Shimei rails against him, picks up stones and throws at David. That was done under the law to the adulterer or the adulteress. David is being treated just like the adulterer or the adulteress. Shimei's persecution, brothers and sisters, no doubt penetrated his soul. But with resignation now, David puts all in God's hand and believes that all is according to God's will. That's a destination all of us should aim to reach. And it is only done. It is only accomplished. It is only developed by cooperating with God in our trials and our difficulties, not kicking against the pricks as it is, not resisting the trials and the difficulties of life, but seeing them as being part and parcel of our necessary life's experiences. Chapter 17 of 2 Samuel. And we touched on this very briefly at the end of yesterday. Brings David now down the other side of the Mount of Olives, and then he travels up in a northerly course on the east bank of the Jordan until he comes to the town Mahanaim. Now, as we read the rest of 2 Samuel 17 and on into the early part of 18, it's at Mahanaim that David resides for the next part of his experience. It's at Mahanaim that David waits while his men, under Joab's direction, go out from Mahanaim into the forest of Ephraim. This is on the east side of the Jordan. And there in the forest of Ephraim, Joab and his men fight against the rebels. And it's there that Absalom finally falls and is killed by Joab's darts. But David, you know, is not with them. Just read the first three verses of chapter 18. David is bidden to stay in Mahanaim. Can you imagine the agony and the torment of the older man David as he sat and waited at the gate of Mahanaim? What will happen to Absalom, my son? How will the battle go? And as you listen to David as he speaks to his men in verse 5, it's obvious that David is concerned far more with the welfare of Absalom than he is about victory over the rebels. It's Absalom his heart goes out for. Can you imagine as he waited at the gate all day long at Mahanaim, wondering how the battle was going to transpire? And no doubt he had an inkling that it must end fatally for Absalom. He knew at this point that he, David, was to ascend the throne. It was inevitable that the revolt would finally be squelched. The agony and the tension that David must have experienced, can we imagine that? And yet it's so very interesting that here at Mahanaim, David's mind, no doubt, was able to reflect back many, many years to the time of what we read yesterday in Genesis 32. For in this very place, Jacob had wrestled as well with his fate. It was here in Mahanaim that Jacob wrestled and finally came out with a full understanding that God was with Jacob. And it was there at Mahanaim, and in the location just slightly beyond it, across the river near Penuel, where Jacob was to see God face to face. It was in this very area between Mahanaim and Penuel, on the river Jabbok, that Jacob was told that his name would be Israel. He would be a prince with God. How appropriate. As David sat in the cool of the day, waiting in that city in Mahanaim, a man like him with his kind of mind and his understanding of the association of places in his own history, no doubt he must have pondered Jacob's plight. Thought about how Jacob had wrestled and met the angel. Thought about how Jacob had seen God face to face. And thought that here, in the very place where David was waiting for the outcome of the battle, Jacob had been told that he would be a prince with God. And interestingly, of course, Jacob, after that experience, went down the Jordan and crossed at a point somewhat higher than what David was to cross later on. The battle's over. Two runners come back and announce with conflicting news that the battle is over and David's son is dead. How he must have been filled with remorse. We know that because as we read in Samuel, when he finally got into the city, he continued to mourn for some days until Joab brought him around. Down the Jordan on the east side, David walks with his men. And he finally crosses at Gilgal. And there, at that very place where Joshua crossed, as we mentioned yesterday, and where an angel was confronted at the beginning of his campaign into Canaan, David's mind must once again have reflected. Here was a key crossing point along the Jordan. Here, many years previous, a Jesus had crossed the Jordan, confronted an angel, and begun to wrestle for the kingdom and finally have it in his hand. Those geographical locations must have been a source of encouragement to David's troubled soul. And yet we might think that during these few days, David must have had sleepless nights. Do you know, brothers and sisters, that's not so? Do you know we have two psalms that tell us David did not lose a wink of sleep? Turn to Psalms 3 and 4. A most interesting insight into David's state of mind during these days or weeks, and it wasn't very long, when he was expelled from Jerusalem and when he agonized and waited for the outcome of Absalom's fate. Psalm 3 and 4 in the original Hebrew Bible apparently were attached at one time as one psalm. The contents of the Psalms reinforce this understanding. Notice the superscription to your Psalm 3. A psalm of David when he fled from Absalom his son. Now let's read this psalm and the one that follows and consider the difficulties of the times, consider the tensions that David was fraught with, and consider the resignation that is revealed in David's heart as he contemplates his difficulties. Yahweh, how are they increased that trouble me? Many are they that rise up against me. An historical link, by the way, with the numbers, the thousands, of course, that Ahithophel wanted to employ, and even more so under the counsel of Archi the Hushite, who asked that all Israel be gathered together to fight the battle in the forest of Ephraim. So indeed, many there were. Many there be, verse 2, that say of my soul, David's, there is no help for him in God. David was humiliated. He'd been expelled from his city. He was on the run by his own son. But thou, O Yahweh, art a shield for me, my glory and the lifter up of mine head. I cried unto Yahweh with my voice, and he heard me out of his holy hill. Did you catch that, brothers and sisters? He heard me out of his holy hill. Though he was fleeing Jerusalem, he continued to worship. Remember how we noticed yesterday how David prayed as he ascended the Mount of Olives? Verse 5. Look what this tells you about David's state of mind. I laid me down and agonized all night? No. I laid me down and tossed and turned and worried about Absalom all night? No. I laid me down and slept. Isn't that an insight into the soul of David? You see, when David shows such firm resignation in his response to Shimei, and can say so firmly to Shimei and to his men and to Abishai, it is the Lord's will. Thy will be done. In other words, it reveals a state of mind in his response to Abishai and Shimei that is crystal clear here in Psalm 3 and verse 5. As he went on to Mahanaim and waited the outcome of the battle, David was able to lie down and sleep. It's not that he was obviously indifferent to his son Absalom. We know he wasn't. But he could sleep. I await, for Yahweh sustained me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people. Now, if you have a pencil, you might want to mark 2 Samuel 17 and verse 1 and see the historical relevance of that comment in the psalm to the circumstances that David was facing during the rebellion. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people that have set themselves against me round about. You see, brothers and sisters, what it tells us? It's hard to come to this state of mind. But what about our problems that we bring with us? The day is over. We have come home from a difficult arranging meeting. There have been tensions in the ecclesia, difficulties we're facing. Or perhaps we have family problems. All kinds of difficulties face us day by day. And if you're like myself, it's often very difficult to sleep at night when we've been facing troubles in the daytime. We are to take our prayers to God. We are to discuss, as Bob has been exhorting us this week, our trials and our difficulties. But the picture given to us is that we are to bring our problems to God in prayer, to His altar, in our mind's eye. But we are to leave our gift, leave our offering, our petition, there at the altar. We are not to then turn around and take them back with us. Let us get down on our hands and knees at night and come to God in prayer. And it won't happen instantly in a night or in a few weeks or perhaps even in a few months, perhaps not even within a year. But taking into account all that Bob has exhorted us about prayer in this past week and combining it practically with the example here of David in Psalm 3, you see the practical exhortation that emerges. If we are coming to God in prayer, if, like David, we are resigned to God working in our lives, if we're convinced that all things work together for good for those who love Him, if we're sure of that and believe it firmly, then let us present our prayers before that altar and let us then leave them there and let God do with them as He chooses. Let us aim, brothers and sisters, and it won't happen quickly, as we've said, but let us aim to develop that kind of resignation. And how do you think you're going to come to that kind of resignation? You know, there's only one way. To live the life of David. To see your life, in a sense, as he saw his, as a stranger and a pilgrim. To accept the fact that you will face trials and difficulties. It's the only way. It is said of David, as we read yesterday, that when he fled Jerusalem, he went the way of the wilderness. And it will be in the way of the wilderness that you will learn to acquire the peace of mind, and I will learn to acquire the peace of mind, the firm but gentle resignation that is expressed here in Psalm 3. There's only one way to develop it, though. You will have problems. You will have stress. You will have times when you find yourself perhaps humiliated by your own failures. But as we've seen with David all during this week, there is no reason for despair. If you find yourself slipping more than once on the same rock, so did David. If you find yourself back in Gath more than once, so did David find himself back in Gath more than once. Repeated sins and repeated errors. No reason, of course, to excuse ourselves, but no reason to fall totally into a sense of frustration and a sense of worthlessness. If David, brothers and sisters, failed as many times as he did, how much more ourselves? Let's go on to Psalm 4. Hear me when I call, O God, of my righteousness. Thou hast enlarged me when I was in distress. Have mercy upon me, and hear my prayer, O ye sons of men. How long will ye turn my glory into shame? How long will ye love vanity and seek after leasing? But know that Yahweh hath set apart him that is godly for himself. The Lord will hear when I call. Now look again at this resignation to his own fate and difficulties. Stand in awe and sin not. Do you know the Apostle Paul quotes this? He quotes it, and the rendering in Ephesians 4 and verse 26, according to the King James, is, Be ye angry and sin not, let not the sun go down upon your wrath. When David says that in Ephesians 4 and 26, he is quoting Psalm 4 and verse 4. That's the force of stand in awe. Be angry, and it's not an exhortation to be angry. Be angry and sin not. Commune with your own heart upon your bed and be still. Now think of David in Mahanaim. Think of him as he camped night after night as he trekked down the Jordan, lamenting the fate of his son Absalom, who was now dead. Put the psalm in its historical context, and it comes alive. It's rich with exhortation. Think of how tempting it was for David to have turned and tossed all night long as he lamented his son and his foolish decision, as he smarted at the rebukes and the disloyalty of his friends, former friends. As he thought of all the dishonesty and the intrigue that had riddled his court, so many reasons for tension and stress. And yet, David allowed the tensions and the pressures to be released when he came in prayer. He's exhorting us, and he's basing it on his own practical experience. Be angry. Did David have reason to be angry? He had more reason to be angry, brothers and sisters, than you and I have ever had. He was filled with anguish, filled with remorse, and no doubt had good reason to be bitter in his own soul for the kind of response that was given to him, considering how he was merciful and forgiving to Saul and to many others. Be angry, if we are angry, and sin not. Think of how Paul uses that in Ephesians 4. And the force that it has coming from David, given his circumstances. To commune or talk with ourselves upon our beds and be still. Offer, verse 5, the sacrifices of righteousness and put your trust in the Lord. There be many that say, Who will show us any good? Yahweh, lift thou up the light of thy countenance upon us. Thou hast put gladness. Look at what David is saying. You wouldn't have thought that there was an ounce of gladness that could have exuded from David's heart in those circumstances. But there was. Triumphant gladness, a spiritual joy deep in his soul, because he was now positive that God was working in his life, and there was no sense in trying to kick against the circumstances. Thou hast put gladness in my heart. Notice where the gladness comes from. It's not that David had sort of conjured up gladness in himself. There was a gladness that came external from David and presided over all his feelings. A gladness that subdued his emotions and his feelings and poured a balm upon all the bitterness and the fire that was within him. Thou hast put gladness in my heart, more than in the time that their corn and their wine increased. That's the language of harvest. Harvest was a time of gladness. The fruit had come to its fullness. There were tokens of Yahweh's blessing. Men and women rejoiced and thanked God for the blessings of the harvest. David says that in these difficult circumstances now, he has a greater sense of gladness, a greater sense of joy, than even those who rejoice at the time of harvest. He is resigned to his fate. Verse 8, I will both lay me down in peace and not toss and turn, not rehearse all the events of the day, not imagine in a kind of mental dialogue, what am I going to say to him tomorrow, or how I'd like to put it at the next arranging meeting to that person, or how I'm going to get on the phone the next day and get things off my chest and ventilate. And thus, a night is spent, and the sheets are perhaps disheveled, and the pillow is askew. All during that night we sleep not. No peace. Although we've perhaps said our prayers before that night began, before we went to bed, but our prayers meant nothing. If we have not taken our offering and left it at the altar, and indeed left it there, and let God respond the way he wishes in his wisdom, I, says David, will lay me down in peace and sleep, for thou, Yahweh, only makest me dwell in safety. Brothers and sisters, when we do face that kind of challenge to our faith, don't be surprised that you find it difficult to come to David's state of mind. Don't be frustrated, but aim for it. Perhaps by a reading of David's own life more than once, other than when we're doing the readings, or perhaps reading Psalm 3 and 4 and going back into Samuel and reading a portion of that section we just glanced at yesterday and today. Don't be surprised that you find it difficult, because David found it difficult. And that kind of response that comes from David's soul in Psalm 3 and 4 is after a lot of living. But it is something we should aim for. That, brothers and sisters, is perhaps one of the most revealing insights into the growth and the spiritual maturity of David. In the midst of all his humiliation and his difficulties, David shines forth and shows his true heart. It's that kind of attitude which made David to be what he was. Not that he was flawless, but the kind of mercy he showed, the kind of integrity he demonstrated, and the kind of cooperation he gave to God as God took that David as a lump of clay and molded David's character in the crucible of trial and difficulty, under heat and pressure. David nevertheless cooperated until God could see in David a reflection of himself. There are a number of passages which give a summary overview of David. Let's just remind ourselves, since we're now coming to the end of our study of David, several passages. First of Chronicles, chapter 29. These are summary statements concerning God's view of David. They help us to see what God found most favorable in this man. First of Chronicles, chapter 29. Here, at the time of the temple, close to the end of David's life, David says, verse 1, "Furthermore, David the king said unto all the congregation, Solomon my son, whom alone God hath chosen, is yet young and tender, and the work is great. For the palace is not for man, but for the Lord God. Now I have prepared with all my might for the house of my God, the gold for things to be made of gold, and the silver for things of silver," and so on. And did you catch that phrase in verse 2? "Now I have prepared with all my might for the house of my God." You know, it sounds very much like the language of Paul to Timothy, where he exhorts Timothy to busy himself. How thou oughtest to behave thyself in the house of God. And the word "to behave thyself" means to busy thyself. He exhorts Timothy that he ought to know how he should busy himself in the house of God, speaking of the ecclesia. The attitude of work, the willingness to labor with brothers and sisters, that was a key in David's heart. He prepared whatever he did with all his might, although he often failed. Verse 3, "His eye was on the ecclesia and his brothers and sisters. Moreover," says David, "because I have set my affection to the house of my God, I have of mine own proper good of gold and silver, which I have given to the house of my God, over and above all that I have prepared for the holy house." You know, that tells us that David was a giver, and he was a doer. He was one that was more concerned about working for his brothers and sisters than being a recipient from his brothers and sisters. It was more blessed to David to give than to receive. A man who was busy for God, who, although he failed, was failing in the course of action. And if we are going to be people that do things in the ecclesia and for the community, we're going to fail at times. It's only the people who do nothing that never fail. To be a doer means to be one who will fail at times. But that was what God was looking for. God could work with a man like David, who viewed the ecclesia as being the object totally of his affections and his energies. His affection was for the ecclesia, and he was willing to, according to verse 3, sacrifice his own material goods and his energy for it. 1 Kings chapter 9, another insight by way of a summary of David. 1 Kings chapter 9. This is at the time of Solomon. I'd like to look at verse 3 and 4 of 1 Kings 9. "And Yahweh said unto him, I have heard thy prayer and thy supplication that thou hast made before me. I have hallowed this house which thou hast built to put my name there forever. And mine eyes and mine heart shall be there perpetually." And he says to Solomon, "If thou wilt walk before me as David thy father walked, in integrity of heart and in uprightness, to do according to all that I have commanded thee, and will keep my statutes and my judgments, then I will establish the throne of thy kingdom upon Israel forever." What was there about David's heart that placed him in tune with God despite his failings? David had, as an overall picture of his heart, integrity. In other words, his motives were pure. Failed as he did, he had the motive of pleasing God most of the time. He had uprightness of heart. That is what we are striving for, to emulate David's integrity and his uprightness. If we do, through a period of trial and difficulty, perhaps at times, through thick and thin, through top of the mountain to the valley, all of those circumstances and their sum total will generate within us, through a slow process of development, the uprightness and the integrity of heart that God is looking for. What else was there about David's heart? He was merciful. All those years, the 12 of them, when he fled from Saul, as tempted as he was, and perhaps we could say as justified as he was, to rail against Saul or to snuff out Saul's life, David showed mercy to Saul. Mercy. With what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again. If we wish to find mercy in God's court, if we wish to find grace before his throne of grace, we in our own lives must be like David and show mercy when opportunity allows. So that was important. There was also an attitude that was self-sacrificing in his attitude towards the ecclesia. Let's 2 Samuel again. 2 Samuel chapter 24. Each one of these precious incidents is like a shaft of light on David's heart. 2 Samuel chapter 24. This is at the time of the numbering of Israel. We're not going to go into the circumstances surrounding the numbering of Israel, but I want you just to notice, first of all, verse 1. Again, the anger of Yahweh was kindled against Israel, and he moved David against them to say. Notice, against whom is God angry? He is angry against Israel, not David, to start with. And so the numbering takes place, and we notice that David is then confronted by Gad the seer. Verse 14. This is the Gad that we met earlier on, that came down to him in Adullam and told him to stay in Judah. Verse 14. David said unto Gad, I am in a great strait. Let us fall now into the hand of Yahweh, for his mercies are great. And let me not fall into the hand of men. Now, David sees that there's a pestilence sent by God. And how does David respond as he comes to God in prayer? Remember, God was essentially angry with Israel, not David. Verse 17. And David spake unto the Lord when he saw the angel that smote the people, and said, Lo, I have sinned, and I have done wickedly, but these sheep, what have they done? Let thy hand, I pray thee, be against me, against my father's house. Now, think carefully of the kind of mind and attitude that reveals. What have these sheep done, David? We could answer, plenty. These were the sheep that had rebelled against him. This was the nation that had shown fickleness for many, many years. This was the nation that had not expelled the people of Canaan, and thus were facing the incursions of the Philistines up to the hill or the area of Bethlehem. This was a nation that was far from perfect. This was a nation, when compared to David, who was a man after God's own heart, did not deserve even to be compared with David's integrity and uprightness of heart. But David doesn't rail against the ecclesia. He doesn't say, they, the ecclesia. He talks about himself, like Nehemiah and Ezra and Daniel, when he prays about his nation's problems. He identifies himself with the sheep, and he begs for God's mercy. He doesn't leave the sheep when there's problems and difficulties. He sees them all as God's people, despite their weaknesses and their failures. It's that attitude towards the ecclesia of God that we must emulate. It's so very easy to talk about they when we talk about our brothers and sisters, to step aside as if we were aloof from the weaknesses of our own community. Weaknesses are there, but let's be like David, or like Ezra, like Nehemiah, who, when they prayed for forgiveness and God's mercy, identified themselves with the body of Christ, saw themselves as a member that was part of that organic body, not standing aloof from it and looking at its sores, but part of the body that was afflicted. That's the attitude of David, not only as an elder, but as a fellow brother to his nation, to his ecclesia. And you see what it reveals about his self-sacrificing attitude. He speaks here like Moses, doesn't he? What have they done? Let thine hand, I pray thee, be against me and against my father's house. David's house didn't deserve recrimination. His house didn't deserve to be plagued. His house was a righteous house. Jesse and his sons, they didn't deserve that. But David is willing, like Moses, to step in and, with his self-sacrificing attitude, allow himself to be taken instead of his people. Think of what Bob said this week earlier on. That quotation from John's epistles. Greater love, and from John's gospel. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man should lay down his life for his friends. See what David's doing? He is willing to lay down his life for his friends, even though his friends don't fully deserve it, even though he has greater integrity. When we are faced with frustrations in the ecclesia, when we know perhaps we're justified in our claims, when we have been insulted perhaps or offended, when we are annoyed or disappointed at the lack of integrity in others, let us remember how David approached the problem and how he viewed himself in relationship to that problem. You see how David has his heart in tune with God as he viewed his brothers and sisters is ever so revealing about how David viewed the ecclesia. And look at how the psalmist summarizes David's relationship to his brothers and sisters. Psalm 78. Part of this psalm, starting around verse 60, reviews the period of Samuel. It's a most interesting lead-up to the climatic statement at the end of the psalm. We see in verse 60 the early period of Samuel. Speaking of God, that he forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh, the tent which he replaced among men. And it's going to lead up to David. And since the tabernacle shifted out of Shiloh, which was in Ephraim, and came down finally to Zion, the historical background of the psalm picks this up. Verse 67. Moreover, he refused the tabernacle of Joseph, and chose not the tribe of Ephraim, but chose the tribe of Judah. This is under David's rule. The Mount Zion, which he loved. Verse 70. He chose David also his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds, from following the ewes, great with young. Look at that language. Why does the psalm zero in on the young lambs, the tender lambs, the innocent lambs, those that were unable to protect themselves? Because David was tender. He was merciful. He cared for the young and for those that were gullible or vulnerable. First on the hills in Judea, and then later as he came in and served God in the courts. From following the ewes, great with young, he brought him, David, to feed Jacob, his people, and Israel, his inheritance. So he fed them according to the, and here's that phrase again, integrity of his heart. And he guided them by the skillfulness of his hands. Those of you that are arranging, brethren, do you view your role that way? Like David, do you look out for the ewes that are great with young, the mothers in Israel, the young mothers especially, the children of the ecclesia? Do you see your role as an elder, as being in a position to feed and to lead with skillfulness of hand? But that's not just a role of the elders. That is a token of the relationship all of us should have with one another. We are all sheep, but we also have a responsibility to help shepherd one another and one another's children, to see ourselves as mothers and fathers in Israel and fellow brethren, all part of one flock. And what about that term in verse 72? It's not just that God asks us to feed one another. He wants us to do it with skillfulness of hand. What does that imply? Think about it for a moment. It's not just that we have a bucket of food and that we spread it out anywhere like a man feeding chickens. We are to feed one another with skillfulness. That means that we can give a word in due season, not just speaking truth, but knowing when to say it and how to say it. It means, like David, our minds and hearts must be saturated in God's word so that we know what we should draw from in the great well of salvation. It's not just a word spoken. It's a word duly spoken. A word in season is what God is looking for, not just a word. Let us, brothers and sisters, by applying ourselves to this word, acquire skillfulness in the application of the food that is needed to feed one another. It's a perception, an outlook that David has to the ecclesia, and it's an outlook towards himself. He didn't parade himself over the sheep, but like the master, he guided them with tenderness and with care. That's a role all of us should have in our relationship to one another. Another insight into how David viewed himself, the ecclesia, and his worship of God. I'd like to go back to 1 Samuel again. What we're doing now is just drawing from highlights at any place in David's life to try and build up, by way of climax, a final impression of the man after God's own heart and what it was that made him and gave him that kind of heart that God was pleased with. 1 Samuel chapter 26. We glossed over this section a few days back, and we skirted around this verse because we wish to reserve it to our final comments. Now, if you have your chart, you can pretty well plot where we are. In 1 Samuel 26, this is just after the time of his incident with Abigail and Nabal. It's during the 12 years of himself being a fugitive. He is still fleeing from Saul. This is, of course, the second occasion when David is given Saul right into his own hands. It's the second time that David could have seized Saul and killed him outright. And there's a dialogue, of course, going on here between David and Saul as David rebukes Abner for his lack of loyalty and not sleeping close enough to Saul. That's mentioned in verse 15. Now watch what David says and look at the insight it gives you. Verse 19 says David, yelling across the valley, "Now therefore I pray thee, let my lord the king hear the words of his servant." Watch what David says. "If the Lord have stirred thee up against me," meaning Saul, to David, "let him accept an offering. But if they be the children of men, cursed be they before the Lord." Now, what's he saying? If it's God who has stirred up Saul against me, well, then there is resignation for that. There is an offering that could be offered also if Saul is doing this from his own wrong motives. Or, if they be the children of men, if influences have come down upon Saul, if he's been encouraged by other agitators, if they be the children of men, cursed be they before the Lord, for they have driven me out this day from abiding in the inheritance of Yahweh, saying, 'Go serve other gods, David.'" That was never said to David, according to the records. What does David mean as he interprets these circumstances in that light? He views his persecutors, "For they have driven me out this day from abiding in the inheritance of the Lord." And by persecuting David, by giving him no peace, by driving him out of Jerusalem, or from the place of worship, before Jerusalem was established, let's say from the tabernacle of worship, by driving David out from where he could worship at the tabernacle, what have they done to David? In doing so, to David they have really said, "David, go and serve other gods." Isn't that an interesting construction of the events? See what it reveals about David's attitude? David is really saying, we believe, brothers and sisters, that by him being forced to live the life of a fugitive and not having access to the tabernacle where he could worship, not having access to the representations of holy things, not being able to have access to the place of the ecclesia where he belonged and where he longed for, David felt that by being out of the presence of that tabernacle, he was really being forced by his friends to turn upon the gods of the land. He wanted to be near the ecclesia. He wanted to be within the borders of the land and live in peace and quiet. He wanted to have access to the tabernacle, to the symbols of God's holy truth. He would have missed deeply the breaking of bread on Sunday morning. It was no light thing for God not to worship, as for David not to worship, as he wished to worship. You see, David didn't take those things lightly. How about you and I? Can you excuse yourself from the breaking of bread easily, without a lot of remorse? Do you find any deep loss in not regularly attending ecclesial functions? Do you find it doesn't bother you too much and you don't feel any real lack of strength if you miss the Bible class on a regular basis? If you miss the lectures? You know, David smarted in his own soul when he couldn't carry on regular concourse with his brothers and sisters, especially when he wasn't able to come into the presence of God on a regular basis, when he couldn't sit in the tabernacle or near it and contemplate the meaning of those holy things and all that they portrayed, that God was dwelling with Israel between the cherubim. That is the heart and the greatness of David. Brothers and sisters, let's just turn to one of the Psalms by way of conclusion. It tells us so much about David and how he viewed his relationship to his God, how he yearned for the presence of God and for him to be there with it. We've already seen this psalm before, Psalm 63. Here is a man of the ecclesia. Here is one who wished to be with his brothers and sisters, who wished to feed them, who wished to develop skillfulness of hand in working with his brothers and sisters, who identified himself with the body, and who walked humbly amidst his brethren, and this is one who would never have missed a meeting. Verse 1, Psalm 63. O God, thou art my God. Early will I seek thee. My soul thirsteth for thee. My flesh longeth for thee in a dry and thirsty land where no water is. To see thy power and thy glory, so as I have seen thee in the sanctuary. To be otherwise, God felt, or David felt rather, he was being forced to become an idolater. To be on the run like he was for so many years, David felt that he was being tempted to accept the worship of the nations around him. To see thy power and thy glory, so as I have seen thee in the sanctuary, because thy loving kindness is better than life, my lips shall praise thee. Thus will I bless thee. While I live, I will lift up my hands in thy name. My soul shall be satisfied as with marrow and fatness, and my mouth shall praise thee with joyful lips. As we now come to the end of our study, let us more keenly appreciate both the strengths and the weaknesses of David, a powerful source of encouragement for prayer, for interpreting our relationship with our fellow brothers and sisters, and as an antidote against frustration and despair when we fail. Here's the positive note, verse 11. But the king shall rejoice in God. Everyone that sweareth by him shall glory, but the mouth of them that speak lies shall be stopped.